There are two ways of looking at human beings, and they have competed with each other all through the centuries. It so happens that both of them are described in a single speech by Shakespeare's most famous tragic hero, Hamlet. You'll have to forgive him for using the word man to mean both men and women. No one in the early 17th century was criticizing verbal sexism yet. I want you to listen to the language and the thought as they soar through several eloquent phrases and then drop with a thud back to earth. What a piece of work is a man. How noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, in action, how like an angel, in apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. And yet, to me, what is this quintessence of dust? If an actor delivers that speech skillfully, the audience almost literally swells with pride as the grand compliments unroll and then crumples when the actor's face changes, his tone goes from eulogy to scorn, and he closes with his own despairing image of humanity as the embodiment of dust, a mote that spins its brief dance in the sunlight and falls to silence. Hamlet, like any other intelligent man or woman, saw evidence at different times for holding both opinions. We are godlike in reason. The beauty of the world, we are, it often seems, no more than quintessence of dust. If you read a book now and then in popular ethnology, you may remember some titles of several years ago which suggest that we are no more than animals among animals, naked apes dominated by our own savage biology and driven by killer instincts. The implication is that we may as well put up with unbridled greed and lust, cruelty and violence because they are part of our genetic makeup. It isn't hard to want to buy that argument when you look around, but like Hamlet, I find some evidence for a more hopeful view. Not surprising in my case, because I trust a teacher who said centuries ago that if we accept his philosophy, we find power to become sons and daughters of God. Not angels, mind you, with the wings and perfection of popular mythology, but men and women provoked into dreaming, filled with high longing, and separated by their new life from the dim world of brutishness. The images in the Sermon on the Mount are not as grandly poetic as they are in Hamlet's great speech, but in their homespun simplicity, they pack a tremendous wallop. You are, that great teacher said, the salt of the earth. A hopeful compliment, followed by an even better one, breathtaking in its expectation. You are the light of the world. And elsewhere, by implication, We are like leaven, fermenting inside the apathetic dough of society to make it rise in spite of itself. Now, are such things possible? Or is this only more of Christian mysticism dressed up in pretty words? Can we be salt, light, and leaven? Or are we actually doomed to endless repetition of our animalistic savagery? Robert Ardrey, in The Territorial Imperative, takes the dim view. He tries to make us believe that no matter what Freud said or was thought to have said, getting and holding property is far more important over a total lifetime than sex, and makes us forever belligerent. He tries to prove it from the world of animals. Conrad Lorenz, in a book called On Aggression, and Desmond Morris, in another called The Naked Ape, both concluded that we were animals doomed to violence. I hoped, as I read those, that somebody would take a more hopeful view, and sure enough, a man named Alexander Alland, in a book called The Human Imperative, did exactly that, describing us as creatures who can be modified by our culture. He argues that if we were innately and inevitably aggressive, then all human beings would behave in predictable ways. But they don't. He cites the Sema'i people of Malaya, who adopt and name animals, talk to and caress them as if they were children. Youngsters in that society are never physically abused. They rarely see any form of violence, and so they have no models of aggressive behavior to imitate. One result is that murder was unknown among those people. His conclusion is that aggression is not instinctive and war is not inevitable. Culture is the major determinant in human existence, and so the human imperative of his title is that we develop a kind of culture in which war is impossible. And this, I think, is exactly what Christ had in mind when he proposed a new kind of humanity, a culture called in his day the kingdom of God. He would have people grow up in an atmosphere of love and compassion until wars and cruelties would be utterly foreign to their nature. So foreign that if war were forced on them, they would wage it with regret and not with hatred. That would sound like hopeless idealism and pure poppycock, except that here and there, somebody is forever making just that radical a change. I remember a Sports Illustrated essay I read once about Muhammad Ali. It was entitled, "Got to Look Good to Allah," and there was a little sneer in the title, as well as elsewhere in the story, because Ali had fought one of his bouts with compassion in a business that thrives on cruelty. Late in his fight with Buster Mathis in Houston, Ali had seen that his opponent could not defend himself any longer, that even light punches made him wobble. So he hit him with a gentle right hand. When Mathis struggled up to try again, and now I'm quoting the writer, Ali patted him even more gently with the left and did not throw the right, though in Ali's corner, his trainer was yelling, "Take him out, Ali, damn it, take him out." Later in the dressing room, Ali defended his lack of a killer instinct. "I don't care about all them people yelling, kill him. How do I know just how hard to hit him, to knock him out and not hurt him? I don't care about looking good to the fans or to my manager. I got to look good to God. I mean, Allah. I got to sleep good at night. How am I going to sleep if I just killed a man in front of his wife and sons to satisfy you writers?" One of the writers asked him, "Do you think you're in the wrong business?" Ali looked at the man soberly for long moments before he replied, "Yes, I am. I've been watching fights on television and thinking, what's the sense two men getting up there and beating each other up for other people to watch? We got enough killing and hurting in the world. If there was something else to do, I'd do it." Somebody reminded Ali that in earlier fights, he had not been kind, that he had carried almost helpless men along out of cruelty while he beat them savagely. Ali said, "Those were the days when he was filled with hate. Now them days have gone forever. I don't need to do like I did then. I'm more educated and more civilized." I remember thinking as I read that, well, thank God for proof that a man can grow up and see mind as more precious than muscle and compassion as nearer to God than quickness. But the writer of that essay took an opposite view, saying that Ali's brilliant career seemed likely to end not with a bang, but a shrug. Who wants to watch a fighter who has lost the killer instinct, a superb fighting machine that has developed, of all things, a conscience, an animal that has become human and grown concerned about the favor of a God? The wonderful thing about these creatures that some call only naked apes is that they are forever escaping that prison just when we think they have been caught and labeled. A religion speaks to them. It says, learn to be gentle. Let love decide how you act. And they listen, and some dim spark flames up until they begin to act like children of God. It's a matter of conditioning. And because personality can be shaped and altered, I wish we cared more about the culture that molds our children. I hadn't thought about that as much as I should have until my wife began to teach in grade school and came home night after night to share the stories about that 6-year arena where the first great battles of life are fought away from the immediate family and where patterns of behavior are set that may last a lifetime. The triumphs won there and the maiming that happens there are unbelievable to those who do not see them intimately day after day. The damage may be done at home first by parents who quarrel and fight and think the children are unaffected because they laugh nervously or they go quietly to their rooms, but who the next day in school, any teacher can tell you, may sit all day long in sullen isolation, or be violently aggressive toward another child, or throw a hysterical tantrum all by themselves. I am convinced that most parents like that have no idea how much they contribute to the psychological maiming of their children. But on top of that, our highly competitive society adds its share at times by pushing the spirit of organized competition ever farther back into early childhood. Outdo one another in grades, outstrip one another in pressure-packed games, win at all costs. Hear the gospel of a famous coach who can say, winning is not just everything, it's the only thing. True story. True story about how that works out sometimes. The little boy's name was Russ, and he was not well coordinated or quick. So in the competitive games they were playing that day in second grade, all excited about a chance to please his peers for once, Russ dashed off in the wrong direction. There was a general howl of dismay, since winning was all important. But there was also the one boy who yelled, "Oh, Russ, you're going the wrong way, you stupid idiot." It was too late to retrieve anything, so Russ simply turned back, his face red, and walked back to his place. As he passed the boy who had yelled at him, that one said again, loudly enough for everybody to hear, "You dummy." Russ jerked spasmodically, stopped for just a second, but didn't say anything, and a teacher told him to sit down. Suddenly, without warning, he began to scream, his face flaming and convulsed, "I'll kill you, Brian, I'll kill you." He began kicking and flailing his arms, and had he been big enough and strong enough in that paroxysm of rage, he would have killed. There was murder in his heart. A different teacher who passed by just then but had seen nothing of what went before grabbed Russ by the shoulders, shook him until his head bobbed back and forth violently, and yelled, "Russ, don't be a baby." That was Russ's conditioning for that particular day. No villains at work in this little drama. Just that it's hard to remember or to commit ourselves to the long, slow, delicate process of creating a human being. And in all fairness, there are lots of other moments when somebody does remember to be salt or leaven or light. True story. It was the second day of school one year, and for the second time, the only kid in the room without a book bag was Eddie. The book bag, you know, is as essential a part of arriving at school as the scissors and glue and the old red chief's notebook were when I was a kid. So Eddie stood out differently all day, struggling with books that slipped and fell on the floor. Mrs. Johnson had thought on the first day that he must simply have forgotten to bring it. But on the second day, she thought she'd better ask. So at the door, as he bent over to retrieve a dropped notebook, she put her hand on his shoulder. "Eddie, do you have a book bag?" His face was a roadmap of embarrassment. "No, ma'am." She looked more closely at his clothes, the tennis shoes left over from last year, the sleep tousled hair that no one had bothered to mention as he left home, and she made a quick decision. "Oh," she said, "I have yours around here someplace. Apparently no one remembered to give it to you I'll have it here for you in the morning. That night, she stopped by Walmart, and no one there had the slightest notion that she was salt and light and leaven.